So we're continuing to make our way through 1 Peter. Go easy on me this afternoon if you know the passage, if you're familiar with it. We're at 1 Peter 3, doing verses 1 to 7. So if we could have those up on the screen, please, Anthony. Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behaviour of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewellery or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to adorn themselves. They submitted themselves to their own husbands. Like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her Lord. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner, and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. So this, I think, is perhaps a controversial passage, a difficult passage. I think it's a difficult passage to read, to hear, particularly if you are a wife or a woman in general. I think it's a difficult passage for anyone who wants to kind of present the gospel as something that is empowering and freeing rather than oppressive. I think it's one of those passages that, as we think, it's important that we understand sort of the context of the passage in the letter that Peter's writing, in the situation he's writing to. So that's what we will be thinking about this afternoon. That's important to understanding this passage. But I think it is, you're right, I would say this is an offensive passage, but it's probably not offensive in the way you might think it is from first reading. But I think it's offensive in a different way, which we'll come up to. So if you remember, we've been going through 1 Peter, and Peter's writing to a group of churches in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, who are part of the Roman Empire. They are a minority and they are viewed with suspicion by the culture around them. Kind of, Oz referred to it last week, that in the years to come, outright persecution would break out against the church. But at this time, it's kind of like things are hanging in the balance. They are viewed with suspicion, they are persecuted by the society around them, but it's not quite outright trouble for them yet. This is the context in which Peter is writing. And last week, Oz sort of talked about how Peter moved on to, you know, as your church is in this situation, this is how you should live. He spoke about respecting authority, you know, whether you agreed with it or not. He spoke about slaves honouring their masters, even if the masters don't deserve it, even if the masters treat them badly. And he says, do this because Christ did it. Christ submitted himself to injustice and cruel treatment. And then Peter goes on to move on to chapter 3 passage. We've lost the slides. Where he says, if I can call it from memory, this is the challenge here. I don't need to now. Slides will come back. Wives, in the same way. So he's following on from what's gone before. In the same way. He's referring to what he's just said about authority and slaves and masters and Jesus. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behaviour of their wives. So it's all the same argument. And underneath this argument, these arguments he's making, Peter is essentially saying the same thing. He's saying, don't give the culture around you a reason to accuse the church. Don't give them a reason to accuse you of being troublemakers and criminals and things like that. Live in such a way that you don't make it harder for people to respond to Christ, to respond to the gospel. So this is what he says here. Why does he say, be submissive to your husbands? So that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over, without words, by the behavior of their wives, by your character rather than your words. In the culture Peter's writing to, the Roman Empire, women, although they had more rights and sort of more standing than slaves that we heard about last week, they did not have the same rights, they did not have the same authority, the same standing, the same respect as men. That was the way the culture was. They were limited in their ability to make their way in the world. And Peter, again, refers to this at the end of this section when he's giving advice to husbands in the same way, again, following on the same argument, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner, meaning they are in this culture, they do not have the same authority as you, they do not have the same opportunities as you, they are weaker in this regard. But Peter is definitely not saying, you know, women are therefore lesser or inferior or anything like that, because he goes on to say, treat them as the weaker partner and as heirs with you. So it's quite the opposite. He's saying treat them with respect, because although this culture may sort of put them in a weaker place, they're actually, in God's eyes, heirs with you. They're equal and they're to be treated with respect. They're not lesser. I think this is important because this is the kind of passage that over the years it's possible to abuse or to use to actually oppress others rather than kind of understand others as being sort of heirs with each other. And in the past, I guess it's possible that men have used this passage to sort of take the view that women should always be sort of submissive and subservient to all men all the time, and women are somehow not as important or somehow lesser because, you know, they're the weaker partner. It's in the Bible. Peter says so. So that must be true. But of course, that's not what Peter is saying here. That's not a good way to read the Bible. If you want to read the Bible that way, you can. But it's a dangerous thing to do because you may find yourself at the end of time sort of queuing up to stand before God and give an account for your life. And you look and next to you on one side is kind of Mother Teresa or Florence Nightingale. And on the other side is Gladys Aylward or Corrie ten Boom or Jackie Pullinger or someone like that. And you might feel a bit embarrassed kind of standing next to them. So it's probably best not to interpret the Bible that way. It's probably best not to take that view. Because the message of the gospel is not that, you know, some people are better than other people. It's quite the opposite. The message of the gospel that comes through from Christ's teaching all the way through the New Testament is this, as Paul puts it in Galatians. You are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. This is the message of the gospel, that we are equals, all loved by God, all with equal access to God, all with equal place in his purposes, all with equally important roles to play. And Peter himself confirms this by reminding husbands that their wives are heirs with them. You know, they are equal with them. And in the culture that Peter is writing to, this was a kind of an unusual idea. Being born a man was kind of a head start. You had more opportunities, you were considered a bit more important. When you're talking about heirs and inheritance, if you were a man, you were probably going to inherit, or more likely to inherit than any sisters you had. And although we're sort of 2,000 years away from that, it's strange to think, even in this kind of enlightened age where we've moved away from that, these same issues keep coming up. You've just, even this year in the news, making headlines, these questions of whether women should be paid the same as men for doing the same job. You know, it's still an issue. If you've sort of been keeping up with the news over the past couple of weeks, and the trial finally of Harvey Weinstein, being found guilty, and the whole idea that for, you know, not for a long time, there was an entire industry or parts of an entire industry that were unsafe for women, if you were a woman. So it's quite interesting, I think, that even 2,000 years later, this issue of viewing one another as kind of equally valuable in God's sight is still a live issue, no matter how much we feel like we've moved away from that, how much progress we feel like we've made. The message of the kingdom of God is very different to the message of the Roman Empire or the United Kingdom. In the kingdom of God, every member is a joint heir. Every member stands to gain equal inheritance. Every member is valued. Every member is valued the same. As Paul tells us, he uses the metaphor of the body to say that every aspect of the body is valuable and necessary. Not everyone has the same role, not everyone is expected to do the same things, but everyone is valuable and important in God's sight. And this was a radical message in Paul's time. It's kind of a radical message now in some ways. It still is. It's a radical message. The idea that although, you know, male and female had different standings in society, they were both heirs. It was a radical message to say, well, slaves and masters are actually equal in God's sight and both going to be judged the same way. This was a radical message. But it was also, like most radical messages are, it was a dangerous message, particularly in the Roman Empire, where the sort of the social structures were important, the sort of power relationships were important, and you didn't tend to move in your social scales so much, and certain jobs like being an actor was kind of looked down upon and considered, you know, a bit of a disgraceful thing to do. This was kind of a radical and important and dangerous message to say, well, actually, slaves and masters, in God's eyes, they're the same. That, you know, male and women are both equal heirs in the kingdom of God. This was a dangerous message. And this is, I think, the kind of the point of what Peter is saying. This is what undergirds all his advice. He's basically saying, don't let the freedom the gospel gives you turn you into someone who damages the reputation of the gospel. He says in the passage Oz used last week, he says explicitly, live as free men and women, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. And he goes on to say later, quite explicitly, look, if you're going to be persecuted, if you're going to be persecuted, make sure you're being persecuted for the right thing. Be persecuted for following Jesus. Be persecuted because you worship God. Don't be persecuted because they say he's a troublemaker. She's a revolutionary. She's a criminal. Don't give the culture around you an excuse to persecute you, other than the fact that you worship Jesus. If they're going to persecute you, let it be for that. This is kind of what Peter's saying. This is his the thrust of his argument through this letter, I think. Live in such a way that the only accusation the culture can bring against you is that you follow Jesus. That's the way to live. Now, there is a thread, of course, through the Bible. We find coming out in the New Testament when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13 in particular to point out that there is something at the centre of what it means to be a child of God, to follow Jesus. I'm just using one verse here from 1 Corinthians 13 to illustrate the point, which is all the way through the chapter. But Paul makes this point. He says, if I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but have not love, I am nothing. So the point kind of Paul makes is that love undergirds everything. It doesn't matter what you achieve. It doesn't matter what you do. If you don't have love, if love is not the foundation of it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't count. It's not worth anything. There's a quote I like from John Wesley, the Methodist preacher. Love is the highest gift of God, And when you are asking others, have you received this or that blessing? If you mean anything but more love, you mean wrong. What he's saying is that essentially, whatever you chase from God, if you're not talking about love, you're talking nonsense. The point is that for the Christian, when we grow, it's not about kind of knowing more or achieving more. Growth for the Christian is to be more, is to love more and to know God's love more. That's the purpose. That's what growth is. That's what we're doing. That's what we're trying to do. Love is the agenda. Love in the New Testament is not kind of this soft thing that says, oh, I don't want to upset anyone. I don't want to offend anyone. What, can't we just all get along? Love in the New Testament is something that aggressively seeks the best of others. That's what love is. This is kind of the love that God has shown for us, and this is the love that we are called to show for others. We are called to seek the best of those around us. And Peter, in this letter, is kind of, this is what he's calling the church to. He's calling the church to love. He's saying, wives, be submissive for the sake of your husbands, for those who don't believe, and also, in a sense, for the sake of the church. Because if you are not, if you start sort of causing trouble, if you start saying, well, like, we're equal with men, we're joint heirs, and I don't have to think about being a wife or what that means, then what's going to happen to the church? What are the authorities going to do to the church? Who's going to suffer for the way that you use the freedom the gospel gives you? And Peter says to men, although, you know, in your culture, in the culture you're in, your wives occupy perhaps a lesser position in the social structure than you do, that is not an excuse to live that way. That's not something you should accept and sort of take advantage of. Rather, you should protect and honour them for their sake. You should love them. So Peter is essentially calling the church to love one another. This kind of teaching, I think, can sting us at times. It can upset us. And I think this is the truly, if you like, offensive thing about this passage, is that for most of us, most of the time, the question in our hearts, the things we're really asking is, what about me? What about me? What about me? My needs, my place, what about that? But this passage essentially is putting forward that the question we should be asking is, what about others? That's at the heart of what Peter is challenging the church to do. So it's not really a passage about husbands and wives or men and women and their relationship, just in a way that the passage last week wasn't really about sort of masters and slaves. It's easy, I think, sometimes to read the Bible and just read it kind of just on a surface level and think, well, that doesn't apply to me because I'm not a wife or I'm not a husband or anything like that. But that's not really what's underneath this passage. Underneath this passage, there is a question which applies to all of us. And it is this: what do you do with the freedom that the gospel gives you? How do you use the freedom that the gospel gives you? That's the question. God gives you forgiveness, blessings, gifts, authority, all kinds of things. What do you do with that? How do you use that? That's the question that should be asked. In our culture, we talk about freedom. Freedom's a big deal in our culture. You've probably picked that up. And in fact, if you've grown up in sort of Western culture, you will probably just have inherited a view of freedom, what it is and how you just sort of, it's important. Of course it is. Everyone thinks that. Everyone knows that. But freedom in Western culture essentially means not being accountable to anyone. It means being free to go where I want, free to do what I want, free to travel, free to change jobs, you know, all those kind of things. That's what being free means. That, you know, no one can tell me what I should do. And even sort of to the extreme, which we have, I'd say, in our culture, which sort of Nadia demonstrated with the plants, is that we are free in our culture to choose things that are harmful to us. We have, that's how important freedom is. The sort of the right I have to do what I want is I'm free to choose things even if they're harmful to me. But the problem we have is that the freedom that the New Testament talks about, the freedom that goes all the way through the Bible, is not that. That's a wrong idea of freedom that we might have. That's not the biblical idea of freedom. Whereas our culture says that freedom is the freedom to do what you want, the New Testament says, no, freedom is the freedom to do what is right. That is what freedom is in terms of how the Bible understands freedom. It's the freedom to do what is right. We have been freed from sin. Why? In order to do what is right. We have been freed from sort of the burden and the curse of the law. Why? So we can, you know, go out and live however we want? No. But so that we can allow the Spirit to write the law on our hearts and live for that instead. We have been freed from fear. We have been freed from the expectations of others. We've been freed from our past and the baggage and the mistakes we have in our past. Why? As Peter said in 2:16, live in order to serve God. That's what we've been freed for. We've not been freed to do what we want. We've been freed to do what is right. In our culture, freedom is a self-centered thing. It's about me. But in the gospel, in the New Testament, freedom is an other-centered thing. It's about you are freed to love others, to serve others. Martin Luther, sort of 500 years ago, captured this in a statement, a paradoxical statement. He wrote this: the Christian is a perfectly free lord of all, subject to none. A Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all. This is how Martin Luther put it. And you look at those two statements, you think, well, they contradict each other. They can't both be true. But what he's saying is that I'm a child of God. I'm free. You know, no, there is no authority. The world has no authority over me because I am a servant of God. I'm a child of God. But precisely because I am a child of God, I willingly serve and submit myself to others. That's kind of the message of the gospel. That's what we've been freed to do. So Peter, following this, is kind of saying, wives, don't let the freedom that the gospel gives make you think, well, you know, I'm an heir, joint heir with Christ, so I don't need to think about what it means to be a wife. I don't need to think about my husband. I don't need to think about the implications of my behavior. Peter's saying, don't live that way. That's using your freedom to do evil. And equally, he says to men, your culture may give you a certain position over your wife, but you don't get to say, well, this is just the way things are, and, you know, this is sort of their lot in life, and I can treat them this way. It's acceptable, it's socially acceptable, it's culturally acceptable, or whatever. Peter says, you don't get to do that because you are a servant too. And your wife is an heir with you. The danger I think we find is that sometimes we take the things God gives us, the gifts God gives us, and instead of using them as a basis for going on to love others, we use them just as a basis for loving ourselves more. We take the things God gives, and our question is, what can I do for me with all this stuff that God's given me? Like, God has set me free from the expectations of other people. Great. So now I don't have to care about other people. I don't have to think about the implications of my behavior on other people. That's not what we've been set free for. I think sometimes we can get stuck in our thinking. Is we think about what God has done for us and we say, thank you, God, for what you've done for us. Thank you for what you've done for me. And we kind of never take that step forward into saying, okay, so what do you want me to do for you or for others? we can kind of get stuck on this idea that the gospel is about what God has done for me. And I've been set free, full stop. Not what have I been set free for. And the danger is, I think, as I've said, that we take what God gives and we think this is about me. Well, how can I use this to help me? How can I use this to benefit me? Rather than thinking about how we can use what God has done to help us love others. Now, there is a couple of things Peter says in this letter that sort of stuck out to me because I thought they seemed a bit odd. And I want to spend a moment just touching on those because I think they're kind of important because they address this issue of kind of the self in us. So there's a lovely picture. This is the passage here. If you remember, Peter mentions the sort of holy women of the past and says, sort of walking their footsteps, they had a beautiful, gentle, quiet inner spirit, which God counts of great worth. And you should be like them. You should walk in their footsteps. And he says, they were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. And that was the first thing that kind of stuck out to me from this passage, because if you know the story of Abraham and Sarah, submissive is not the word I would use to describe Sarah. Like, if you don't know the story, you should go and check it out, Genesis 12 onwards for a few chapters. Like, there's at least two occasions where Sarah actually sort of makes Abraham submit to her. And that, neither of those particularly go well in either case. But the point is, I sort of didn't think Sarah was like this model of submissiveness. That's not kind of what I got from the story. So I kind of, that stuck out to me. But the other thing that stuck out to me in this bit here is where he says, you are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. That stuck out to me because I just thought, if we're talking about submission and loving others, wouldn't it make more sense for Peter to say, do what is right and do not give way to pride? Do not give way to selfishness. Do not give way to stubbornness. Things like that. But he doesn't. He says, do not give way to fear. And I thought about this a bit and sort of looked at the passage and thought about other things. And I think it makes perfect sense because what is it in us that drives ourselves to put ourselves before other people? What is it that makes us put ourselves before other people? I think it's fear that does that. Fear is the opposite of faith. Sometimes you might think you got faith and doubt. Because faith is actually an action, I think, the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is fear, because it is fear that stops us from acting. And faith says, and this is kind of what Peter gets to, I think, and I think it's important to clarify at this point in the sermon, I hope you got the message that I'm not just talking to women here, or I'm not just talking to wives here. I don't really think Peter, although he was addressing the wives, the things he's saying are for all of us, for each and every one of us, and that's important, both the things he says to the wives and to the husbands. So just to clarify, this applies to all of us. You know that faith is the thing that says, I'm going to do what is right, even though it's hard, even though it's difficult, even though it appears to be foolish. I'm going to do what's right, and I am going to trust God with that. I'm going to trust God to honour me in that. I'm going to trust God to come through for me. And that is essentially kind of a theme that runs through this letter, and it comes up, I can't remember if it's come up already, but it will come up definitely in the future passages, where Peter essentially says, look, if you're struggling, just do what is right and trust God. That's kind of the message here. That is faith, to do what is right and trust God. The opposite of faith is fear, which Peter says, don't give way to fear, because it is fear that says, I don't think God is going to come through for me, so I'd better do it. I'd better push myself forward because God is not going to come through for me. If I don't push myself forward and make a big deal about myself, no one's going to know how awesome I am. You know, there's that fear in us that no one's going to realize how amazing we are if we don't push ourselves forward. There's that fear in us that if we don't look after ourselves, no one else is going to do it. If we don't stand up for ourselves, we're afraid everyone's going to take advantage of us. And it's fear that is the opposite of faith. It's fear that stops us from trusting God. It's fear that makes us put ourselves first. And Peter says, don't give in to that fear. Do what is right and develop instead, you know, that beautiful, gentle, quiet inner spirit. And again, I'm going to say that is not just something that women should be pursuing. Right? That is not something just for the ladies. That is something we should all be pursuing, because where does that kind of, what's Peter saying, where's that inner gentle spirit comes from? It comes from a life that is submitted, not to a man, not to another human being, but a life that is submitted to God. That's how we develop sort of that inner life that he's talking about, which is of great worth to God, is by having a life that is submitted to God, trusting God, having faith in God to sort of pull you through and make things right. And I wonder if, like, I'm just speculating here, but I wonder if this is one of the reasons why Peter lifts up Sarah as an example of a woman who submitted to Abraham as Abraham followed the call God had placed on his life. And by doing that, by submitting to Abraham, she also became a part of that story and was submitting to the call of God on his life. That by submitting to Abraham, she was essentially submitting to God and God's agenda. Anyway, I don't know that for certain. Now, there's one final thing I want to pull out. You've done very well so far. Good, we're nearly there. That, again, this is not just for the wives, not just for women. What's the point that Peter makes at the end here about if we do not live this way, if we do not love one another, if we do not allow love to be sort of our primary guidance? It is this. He says, if you don't love those around you, it damages your relationship with God. This, he says, do this so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Conjuring up this idea that failing to respect and love those around you actually can damage your communication with God, can hinder your relationship with God. And I think this, again, is something else that comes through the New Testament, in the Gospels, the way we're about to take communion. One of the things Jesus does say in Matthew is if you go to take communion and you have a problem with someone else in the community, you should resolve that before you take communion. I don't know if we want to allow some time for that before we take communion. But this idea is that the way we treat others is actually connected to our relationship with God. And it follows through the New Testament, and read 1 John, the letter there, where John hammers home this idea that you cannot love God and not love those around you at the same time. You can't do it. And I think Peter kind of is touching on this same idea here. And I think he does later in another passage in chapter 4, which we'll look at. He hammers home this idea that actually loving others is crucial to having a right relationship with God, that the two are interconnected. You don't get to sort of be mean-spirited and critical and harsh and cruel to the people around you and then turn around and say, oh no, things are good between me and God. You don't get to do that. That's not how it works. If you kind of have found yourself in that position where you have broken relationships with people around you, but you think, yeah, me and God, we're good, I think you may have misread the situation. I think you may have made a mistake there. And in fact, the opposite is also true. If you're in a stage of your life where you feel like your relationship with God has gone a bit stale, you're struggling a bit, you're not quite sure, you and God aren't connecting very well, then maybe you should try throwing yourself into loving those around you, loving and serving the people around you, and see if that has an effect on your relationship with God. See if that kickstarts your relationship with God, because I think it would. Because I think that's how it works. I think that's how God set it up to work. The two are interconnected. So there we are, okay? We've navigated a potentially offensive passage. But as I said, I think it is quite an offensive passage anyway, if you understand it rightly, not because of what it says about men and women and their relationships, but because of what it says about us and our desire to put others or not put others before ourselves. I think that's the thing that stings us and our culture. But this is what the passage says. This is what Peter says. And it's a common theme through the New Testament, loving others. It's in there. And we kind of don't have any grounds to complain. We don't have any grounds to resist that, I don't think, because we're about to take communion. And if you want to come to take communion and think, well, you know, I don't really need to love others, doesn't matter how I treat others, you have totally missed the point of what we're about to do. Because this whole idea of putting others before yourself, of serving others, of sort of putting your own welfare to one side in order to seek the best for others, that is exactly what communion is about, because that is exactly what Christ did for each of us.